I hate talking about this guy, but I feel the need to.
Uh-oh. That's not a good lead
in. Stuff that makes me laugh. I get a huge kick out of vision of the future technology stuff failing or being really underwhelming.
Sure.
So the recent AI things that have been completely collapsing, like ChatGPT just putting it's over again when you ask it to write you an essay, really just warms my heart. And I can't get enough of it. And now I'm starting to get AI websites recommended to me in my, because I keep reading those stories.
They think you're interested in AI.
Yes, they think I want my 5-page essay done by tomorrow, written for written for AI.
I could do that.
Yeah, I mean, but anyway, I've been reading too many stories about this, and one of the other stories that keeps getting recommended to me is Elon Musk says with no evidence that chip implanted in brain, you can control the mouse with your thoughts. And I'm like, I can also control the mouse with my thoughts by using my brain to tell it to move my hand to this. I was thinking the same kind of thing as I was thinking with the Apple Vision Pro that we talked about the other week, which is what about this is more convenient than using my phone?
Right? Well, you have to reach your hand out and touch the file folder and then it opens. That seems better to me.
Now, do you think it's more like Minority Report or more like the, Disclosure? What was the one that Cam was talking about?
Yeah, Disclosure, It's going to be like Lawnmower Man, actually.
Oh, okay. The story with the goat guy, right?
Yeah.
I struggle to think of, what possible use a computer brain technology could offer me.
They could serve you ads in your brain.
I feel like they're already doing that.
Wow. It really makes you think, huh?
Yeah.
But of course that costs extra.
Yes. They're making me think is something I think that it is possible for them to do.
I mess up the sound every week.
You don't have to let the listeners in on that. I wouldn't.
They
tell
heard
them.
It already.
Hold on. Maybe I'll fix
no,
it.
No, nobody probably listened not. To last week's episode.
It was too long. It was simply too long. No one could have possibly listened
there
to
were
it.
Too many movies.
Too many movies. I had to cut out an extended argument about the end about whether or not I'm a European pedophile.
And the answer was yes.
For enjoying the film.
We settled on yes.
We did settle on yes. And I am not beating those allegations this week where I make everyone read a Belgian comic book for little boys, Tintin, specifically Secret of the Unicorn and Red Rackham's Treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a ton of these. The reason I chose this, as
How
I will get
million
into,
Tintin cartoons are
there's
there?
24 of them wow. or something like that. They were published over the span of 40 years, starting in the 30s and going up to the 70s and 80s.
The last one was unfinished but published posthumously.
Yes.
Yep.
Alf Art, a real mm-hmm. weird experimental one that didn't finish
because
he died.
He was 80 years old
at
the time. Let him
and
be
he, I'm
he
sure
wants.
He'd been smoking cigarettes the entire time.
Oh, yeah. He's a Belgian.
We're going to be doing some light Belgian racism in this episode to make up for the fact that Hergé himself would have wanted it.
Yeah.
I don't actually know any stereotypes about Belgians.
Waffles.
Yeah, they have waffles. Chocolate. Uh-huh. That's about all
they
I know.
They get mistaken for the French by a lot of English-speaking races.
Okay. I know one Belgian pop star.
We know one Belgian filmmaker, artist, of course.
Maestro. he's Stromae, and that's because he flipped the syllables of Maestro.
What a genius.
Well, that's like a thing they do in French. It's like a portmanteau, but it's like different. Mm. Where they'll just, there's a name for it. They just flip syllables.
It's called Le Comédie. Port.
Le Comédie.
Le Comédie language.
I have a new word.
But who do I have with me here today? I have some of the wonderful adventures from Boy Reporter. I have possessor of 7 crystal balls, Alex.
Hello, that's me. I know what you're thinking. And you're thinking. And you're thinking.
I have someone who is currently in the Americas, Seb.
Yeah, I have been captured by the natives. By that I mean white suburbanites.
And I am your host, Alfred Art Nick. I don't think that's what that's short for, but there's no way for him to tell me because he's dead.
It's true.
You could read it.
Now, I would, maybe I should use one of those crystal balls, but I would like to give a little bit of background here. There's the story of how I came to be thinking about Tintin in the year 2024.
Whoa.
It starts a little bit through the fact that in 2010, 2011, a Spielberg made a Tintin movie that I've heard is really good, including from Seth.
Yeah. Wow. And I actually coincidentally just watched it not too long ago, maybe less than a year ago.
It was made with Weta Digital, which is the company that does the Lord of the Rings special effects. Mm-hmm. And
so they got Gollum in there or what?
Better than Gollum. It's like, it looks really good. Like, it looks like what Zemeckis' stuff should look like.
Yeah, it's what you intended. Yeah. Where it's like...
Better than Polar Express?
Better than Polar Express.
Yeah, wow. It's mo-capped, but it's peaked over the Uncanny Valley.
How many Tom Hanks are in it?
Crawled out of the Uncanny Valley. And the faces, I think, help because they cartoonified everything just enough that you're not creeped out by it.
Hmm. I've thought about that movie because I think about see it on my watch list, like, oh man, I really want to get to that. But also, I recently discovered a website that there are comic books on. My first thoughts were, I'm like, oh, let me go find the things that I haven't been able to get physically or otherwise through normal means. And after searching for old Conan the Barbarian comics that are out of print, the second thing on my list was like, oh yeah, the digital Tintins are all fucked up. I bet that some fans have like a good way of reading them.
Man, because the scans for these were such high quality.
They were incredible.
Yeah,
they almost
looked like they had taken the original like boards.
Yeah, it's like he had drawn them digitally, which we know he didn't do. So when I was a kid, I, at a no longer existing elementary school, in the library, they had a couple of Tintins, but they had the number on the spine of which one they were in the series. And they had like 14 and 18 and 21, and I was annoyed. I'm like, where's Tintin 1? I want to start with Tintin 1.
No, you got to read the beginning.
Yeah.
You got to see what this guy's up to.
And only now, as an adult, looking through this big collection of Tintin comics, am I like, oh, not only did they suck, but they were also racist. and politically charged, at least at first, because there was some anti-communist propaganda in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And some
Tintin kills
African
the Russians.
Colonialism stuff
in the
second one.
The first one is called Tintin in the Land of the Soviets.
Yes, incredibly funny. I do think that if you are interested, you should look up what happens in it, because that is funny enough.
Yeah.
They don't really get good until like 5 adventures in. 4 or 5 adventures in. The Cigars of the Pharaoh, I would say, is the first good one. And then Tintin and the Blue Lotus is like right after that. And that's another one of the quote-unquote good ones, even though it has some fucking some serious shit with Chinese caricatures and Japanese caricatures. But I'm like reading through this stuff and I'm like, you know, I want to know what, like, I'm getting the experience of like, I want to know what happens in the ones I couldn't read as a child. And some of them were massive disappointments, and others I'm like, oh man, I would have loved this when I was 8 years old. Yeah. One of the funnier experiences with that is something we'll discuss a little bit in the second segment. A massive anticlimax in towards the end of Red Rackham's Treasure. That I thought was super funny. I'm like, if I had read this as a child, I would be so pissed off. But as an adult, it's more funny. It's like something I can appreciate.
So The Secret of the Unicorn, which you had us read, and Red Rackham went into the Tintin movie.
Yes.
But they remedied, I don't know if they took from the next thing in the series or they made up.
They take from, because like World War II is starting while he's writing these. Mm-hmm. So he can't like. He doesn't know how that's going to shake out, so he doesn't put any of it in. But then in the next one, I want to say Tintin and the Black Island, they have some like Nazi adjacent characters.
Okay.
Who are,
he didn't
like,
hedge
villains.
His bets. He's like, well, I'm not sure which way this is going to blow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's living in Belgium. If he draws the wrong thing, they're just going to execute him. So.
Yeah. But yeah. So. In the movie, it totally remedies the anti-climax.
I have to imagine.
If it didn't like come from a different comic, which I can imagine that he probably brought something.
Yeah. There like, are some other... Like, it's not like they all end like this. Like, there are... even the one I was just talking about, Cigars of the Pharaoh, has like a crazy ambulance chase and a blow dart with a poison that makes you insane.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
And some really good stuff. Like... I really loved even the climax of Secret of the Unicorn before they go into Red Rackham's Treasure. I liked a lot. It just doesn't have like an explosive ending in Red Rackham's Treasure.
Yeah.
Even though I do think it's good. This isn't on a lot of people's top Tintin books, but it's on mine.
the power rankings?
Because a lot of Europeans love ranking Tintin books, I found. doing research for this, there's so many fucking Tintin rankings. And this one's always like kind of in the middle. But for me, Secret of the Unicorn was the one I read as a kid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I wonder how this adventure would have finished.
Yeah.
I wanted to know.
It's like part one.
It's such a cheese. And there's good stuff there. And like these books, there were a couple of other ones we had. Tintin in Tibet, which I think is very good. That's another one with like, that one doesn't have like a villain. It's all natural disaster rescue stuff.
Climb Mount Everest.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, we have to get this person off this mountain because they're not prepared enough. And like, it's just fighting the elements, but there's still good stuff in there. And like, this is part of what made me want to read in the first place. One of the stories that like really helped grow my interest in reading, because the kind of thing that I was like, just wanted to ravenously flip through. And these books were always taken out of the library. The kids loved Tintin. and I found that to be really, like, the memories of that stuck with me for a long time. And I like digging back for an experience like that, just going back and looking at something that I definitely don't get. Like, the kind of pulpy adventure stuff, I think, you know, some of it for sure was racist. A lot of it was. But you don't get the kind of globe-trotting adventure stuff, even for kids anymore. Like, I mean, think about it.
Was the, like, 80s revival, but it was all based on those 50s serials and stuff anyway.
Right.
Like, not many people have riffed on the riffs on serials.
Right. But I think, and, you know, part of it is because, like you were just alluding to, people didn't grow up with any kind of pulp stories or adventure novels or anything like that to call back to. Like, Spielberg is one of the last guys we have who has any affection for that sort of thing. And when he made Indiana Jones, part of it was came from an unproduced Tintin script, was Raiders. Which I'm like, damn, what kind of unproduced Tintin script did you have? with the Ark of the Covenant. Like, what was going into that? But no.
Tintin's face melts off.
Tintin and the face of God. But that kind of story, your Uncharted, your Tomb Raiders, your Indiana Joneses, this kind of stuff isn't really getting made anymore. This kind of globetrotting adventure sort of thing.
Of course, they just made the film Uncharted a few years ago.
Yeah, which was an adaptation of a 2008 game that also nobody watched. So I feel like I'm making a fair assessment that they just didn't. I mean, they made the mistake of casting Tom Holland as Nathan Drake.
And of course, they made an Indiana Jones film last year.
That they don't do, like, I feel like that one's all time travel, right? Is it not globetrotting adventure shit?
No, it sucks.
So I, coincidentally,
they
I was
go to
just...
like two places in that movie. It's bad.
Come on.
But coincidentally, I was just reading up about this genre, or the genres that kind of go into this.
adventure.
Which, the pulp adventure serial kind of stuff?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, there's some very specific subgenres, such as the South Seas genre, which is definitely racist. But it was, you know, at that time where, you know, Hawaii was made into a state, or yes, Hawaii everyone was...
Polynesian fever.
That. So there, you know, all these adventures about pirates and sailors and going to the Caribbean or to like Polynesian islands or something like that. All that kind of adventure. I was just kind of reading up about that, and also about a, I don't know, Nick, you were talking about being brain rotted by silent movies recently. So I somehow fell into reading up about a director who's, most of his filmography was, what do they call it? Salvage ethnography or something like that. Which is basically, so salvage ethnography is basically you're trying to record and piece together a dying culture. Nowadays, I don't think it's as, it's not as controversial because you are just trying to preserve a culture that is, it's on its way out. But back then, he was, like, doing silent films of, there was one called Nanook of the North, which...
I know that one. An Inuit family.
And then, specifically, the one I was reading about, oh, God, what was it? It was, oh, God, I forgot what it's called now. But it was one where he was on, like, an island and trying to film the family on the island, trying and struggling to survive. But they were, like, in real life, they were, like,
they're
no.
They're just doing
fine. Yeah, yeah, they were doing fine because they're, like, living off the ocean and there's plenty of fish and there's, yeah, whatever.
If you're trying to support not an entire, like, tourism industry or military industrial complex, it turns out that there's a lot of stuff in nature for you to eat and places for you to live and things like that. But...
the reason they don't make these stories anymore is because they're all very racist. I think that's the idea.
They don't have to be.
This may be cope on my part, Alex, but I don't think that stories like this have to be racist. They don't have to be printed in Le Pédophile Raciste magazine.
Well, I think they do, actually.
I think there are ways to handle them that aren't so racist. Like the Tintin movie in 2011... they went to the Middle East, I think it was, it wasn't really handled poorly, I don't think. Like, they definitely kind of, the people who lived there definitely took a backseat to Tintin's adventure, but, like, they weren't, like, in blackface or anything, so.
Low bar, but they don't always clear it. So I think it's important to bring up.
Yeah, especially when your source material is Tintin, and there was literally in the Red Rackham's treasure. He was like a gag bit, unfortunately, in one panel. But there was a guy who was just minstrel, you know, very minstrelly looking. Yeah. And he was just standing in the back of a room where everybody was claiming to be Red Rackham's descendant. And he's there and he's like, obviously not. Mm-hmm. Which was the joke, but not very tastefully done.
I totally get it. But I feel like the kinds of stories like this, like the key to like having a fun globe-trotting adventure, like maybe some of it comes from the idea that in our modern era, there is nothing that we have not discovered.
Yeah.
People think that there is nothing new to learn. There are no hidden secrets, that sort of thing.
We moved on to sci-fi, I think, because...
Yeah, sort of. Like, oh, we'll explore...
It's the final frontier.
In a sense, Tintin does that too. There are two stories about him going to the moon. It's the same story in two parts. I don't want to say that he goes to the moon on non-consecutive occasions.
That would be pretty good.
That sounds insane.
He goes twice? He forgot his wallet.
Yeah, I really think because there's not much left to learn, and because that genre, the globetrotting genre, is so mired in racism and stuff, and I think a lot of people are afraid to touch it now. I think space is what we've done.
Wow. Now we do space racism.
I would like to have both. I think we can have
we should be able to have
adventure globetrotting story. Like, it's nice to have a story, like an adventure story where the like focus is on these like big moments, these like set pieces. Like, I enjoy like a National Treasure style clue hunt as much as the next guy, but I prefer when it's just like, oh, you know, we're going to find that treasure, or we're going to uncover this conspiracy, And the focus is seeing one interesting place and then seeing the next interesting place and just like watching the characters bounce off each other there. Like one of the other reasons I didn't have you guys read The Cigars of the Pharaoh is because fucking Captain Haddock isn't in it yet. And I don't like, he's like one of the main draws of these comics to me is like.
Yeah, Tintin by himself can't really draw
Tintin
me.
Tintin and Snowy, because Snowy sometimes talks in these for some reason. Yep.
And I can't tell if people know that he's saying anything.
I think
it's a Garfield situation.
Yeah,
right?
Like there's maybe.
Sometimes Tintin talks back, but.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
like,
I think he's just reading body language.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Because I mean, like. You know, people talk back to their dogs without knowing what they're saying all the time. Yeah. That happens in real life. So it's not super insane.
Yeah, my cat will go, "Brow," and I'm like, no, it is not treats time, because I know that's what he wants. So I might not have been able to actually hear what he said, but I know what he wants.
You get the gist of it.
Yeah.
If you were in a comic strip, there would be a cartoon speech bubble that would say, treat time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Treat time? No.
But like, having, you know... an alcoholic sea dog, like there to kind of for Tintin to bounce off of is
there's
good.
A freestanding Popeye in
this. Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's not like an especially like strong or skilled at anything other than sailing. Like he that's all he really knows how to do is like he's the guy with the boat. And in the first story,
you need a guy
like
that,
the crab with the golden claws. There's an incredibly funny bit where he quits drinking that they do a little bit again in this one to great effect.
Yeah, they're like, your liver is fucked up. And he's like, I don't care.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask, as part of this loose first segment, if there is anything that you built up in your head as a kid that when you actually like went to go watch it or read it or whatever as an adult, you're like, what the hell? Like, why did I care about this? Like, why... like a positive or negative experience. Like sometimes I would like, you know, you see a movie poster as a kid and your parents won't let you watch it. And then later as an adult, you watch it and you're like, why was I so excited about this? Like,
cause it was a grown up movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something like that. It's, you know, it's Kramer versus Kramer and your mom's like, you can't watch that. And you're like, why not? And then
it's
you watch
two
it's
of
like,
the guy from Seinfeld. Yeah, I exactly. need to see it.
I don't know. I never had that because I wasn't interested in the grown-up movies, really. Uh-huh. I was just like, I want to watch Treasure Planet.
I was just giving you one
watch
example.
Treasure Planet. Yeah.
But I don't know. Like,
was there stuff you couldn't get your hands on? We didn't have an internet where everything was accessible. You know, not everything was downloaded and reposted on websites when we were children.
I think the worst thing I had happen to me with that is that our computer up through... most of the way through middle school. No, actually, we had this computer until I was in my freshman year of high school. It had, I think, 60 gigs on it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it was full of programs and files and whatever. And, of course, Windows XP. So when I got into anime and I started trying to torrent stuff, I tried to watch... I tried to torrent all of Wolf's Rain. And it took weeks, I think, to download
And you're like, man, this is going to be so good when
actually,
it's done.
Actually, I did very much like Wolf's Rain, so that's a bad example.
Oh, okay.
But,
well, I mean, like, look, if it lived up to your expectations, that's one thing. But I mostly meant, like, the gap, right? The gap between not the mystery of not knowing something as a kid and then later returning to it as an adult.
I'll
did you have anything
that.
Like that?
So
or
I had,
did you get immediate instant gratification all the time?
I tried EverQuest.
Uh-huh.
In middle school.
Wow.
And I think EverQuest 2 was out by then. And so one of my classmates, Haley, had been like, oh, you should play EverQuest with me. I was like, okay. And I think she was actually playing EverQuest 2. But I downloaded EverQuest 1, which was still current. And they actually still to this day release expansion packs for that game, which is ridiculous. But so I downloaded that. And then I was just like, what? And then I've tried to go back in current day and... you know, kind of look at it and maybe try it out again. And it's just like too archaic.
You're like, why did I get excited about this?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell was going on there?
Yeah. And they weren't, it wasn't released that far. Maybe like, what was it? Like 5 or 6 years apart from World of Warcraft. But by then World of Warcraft had learned from all the MMOs that came before, including EverQuest and especially EverQuest. So there were just so many differences. So that was one thing. And then I guess the a few weeks ago, like, oh, your last episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Not your last episode, Byron's episode. the swear games, I was like, all right, I'll go try Conquer because this has been built up as like that cool edgy game.
I have one of those stories
and
too.
That was absolutely a disappointment. So I think I had not that I was expecting too much, but it was like worse than I thought. But I've had that a few times with video games where I've tried to go back and watch things and just been like, or not watch things, play things, and I'm just like, I don't really get the hype. But it's because for the most part with those things, it's because I don't have the nostalgia goggles for them. That the things I played from a genre have been improved upon and iterated on so much since then that I am spoiled because I did not play the original versions. It's like Sonic Adventure 2. Which we talked about on the Shadow of the Hedgehog episode.
All right, I got. Well, let me into this. While N64 is on the mind, so we had a family friend that I was really close with when I was younger. They had an N64, and he was like 2 or 3 years older than me, but he had both GoldenEye and Star Wars Shadows of the Empire, I believe, the N64 one. And both of those games I never got to play because I was too young. And I was always so interested in what those could be. And then, of course, I have played GoldenEye in that game since, and they're both, like, bad. But I was like, really into, like, both of those. Like, the idea of playing them.
I did the same exact thing with Kingdom Hearts. Where, like, I don't think Kingdom Hearts necessarily is bad. But, like, everyone was so hyped about it. They were like, oh, my God, it's Disney, but then it's also Final Fantasy. Oh, yeah. My God, look at that. And then
I had that with a lot of PlayStation 1, PS2 games because I didn't have those consoles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Once I picked up a PS2 because my, I didn't have one forever and ever, and I wanted one so bad. And then one day, I was in college by that time, but one day my older brother offhandedly mentioned, like, oh yeah, I have a PS2. I haven't played it in a million years because I think he must have just gotten it while he was in college and then just, you know, never played it because he got busy. And I was like, yo, can I have it? And he's like, okay. So he gave it to me, and mostly the games he had with it were like Ace Combat and
which one?
Splinter Cell.
If it's four, you gotta get my I gotta get my hands on that.
I don't have them anymore. Right. Sorry, I didn't keep any of them.
No, that's all
right. I said, are you ever gonna want these? And he's like, well, one day I'll get like a PS5 or a 6, and then I'll be able to play them. I was
right.
I was like, you can't play these on a PS3 right now. You can't, or a PS4. He's like, oh, okay. So I started playing those things like Sly Cooper. Sly Cooper, I really like art style and stuff, but like the gameplay is just jank.
Seb can be wrong over there, because when I experienced these PlayStation 2 games for the first time, doing almost the exact same thing that you did, that one to me was one of those examples where I'm like, wow, this is as good as I thought it was. Which is so funny.
The controls are just a little bit wonky.
That first one was the one I played. I actually haven't played any of the other ones. The controls, I'm sure, are as bad as you say, and I would just completely overlook them.
I never had that with the like mascot platformers
One example, right?
I don't know how the fucking PlayStation kids lived with fucking Sly Cooper instead of Mario. That's some fucking horseshit.
It's absolutely
that's a raw deal.
It's no replacement for Mario, but the three that they got.
Sly Cooper is very cool.
The three that they got, Sly Cooper, Jack and Daxter, if you can only count the first one, and Ratchet and Clank, are all good in different ways. They're like divergent evolutionary paths. I would not count that. Okay. We're talking PS2. We're not talking PS1. And the PS2 Spyros are not good.
Listen, I like Hero's Tale. That's because I could have it on GameCube.
All right. Well,
and it was also the last one before they like rebranded him.
But yeah, for me, it was always the Forbidden Fruit. It was any game where I could shoot a gun. I'm like, need to do this. Yeah.
That's why
I got into playing PC games, because they couldn't they wouldn't buy me the Xbox. So
PS2 games, like when I had like a big list of ones I wanted to play when I eventually got a PS2, because there were so many things that weren't getting re-released and I didn't have a computer at the time. I'm like, man, I can't wait to play these games. And when I finally did, I made the unfortunate discovery that a lot of them were exactly as good or better than I had heard, which is annoying, because that means that you have to trust and like go through more of them. like, you know, people built up. I love my character action games, my Beautiful Joes and Devil May Cry's and such. People are like, oh, God Hand's the best. It was unfairly maligned and all that, as we've talked about on this show before. And I'm like, yeah, right, whatever. And then it totally blows my dick off when I actually do play it.
5 out of 10?
Yeah, 3 out of 10, actually. Dang. It's the best 3 out of 10 I've ever played.
Unplayable.
It's so good.
The controls are unplayable. They don't make any sense. The
controls are unplayable. That second stick does not control the camera, baby. But also another one that I've considered honestly going back to, even though we already did it as an episode, Outrun 2, Coast to Coast. Mm. Mwah, it's like so fucking good.
We love
it's like
to go from one coast to the other.
Yeah. Oh my God. Such an amazing time. There's still a couple of those, like the kind of cultural like games that people say, oh man, they don't make them like this anymore. And it's true, they don't. And I haven't quite gotten to them. I don't know if you guys have heard of the game Raw Danger at all.
No.
Raw Danger is a PS2 game about like going through disasters, like saving people from disasters like earthquake and flood and stuff, okay. All happening in the city of I want to say it's all happening in Japan. And I was like, this
the
crazy
city of Japan.
It's a PS2 game, sure.
Yeah. But I've heard that one is like insanely good, and I really want to get to that one because it's like the kind of idea that you don't really see right now. The games are getting a little too expensive to make, and so kind of mid-level ideas like that don't really have a
place.
Nick
is pining for the AA game.
I am pining for the AA game. It's a hard thing to get, especially when people are spending enough money to do quadruple A games now. And
the world's first quadruple A game.
Skull and Bones just came out. Emily really wants to play it, and then I'm like, finish your plate of Baldur's Gate 3 first, because I am not, you know, I don't. You're about to experience disappointment for the first time. I want you to enjoy yourself.
Has she
first.
Ever been disappointed by a video game, or do you?
Yes, definitely,
okay.
But not like this.
Not
okay, gotcha.
Calling the shot.
Yeah.
To move off video games real quick.
Yeah.
I didn't do anything else as a kid, so those are my only examples.
So I tried to get into some old fantasy series at one point.
Wow.
So I tried to read, and I've heard it gets better. But I read the first book of Dragon Riders of Pern, which is like a touchstone fantasy series from Anne
McCaffrey. There are big Pern heads out there.
Oh, yeah. They're huge, and there's so many of them. So I read the first one, and it just was like so weirdly gendered. Like, you've got your female dragons and your male dragons, and only this girl can have the magic queen dragon who lays eggs,
and only the girl can get the girl Happy Meal toy, and only the boy can get the boy Happy Meal toy.
Yeah, it was weird, and it's been a while, and I listened to the audiobook, and maybe I should go back and try it again, because I like at the time I was just like, why are they making a big deal about her being like a woman here and stuff like that. But maybe I was reading too much into
it.
I don't know.
This smacks of gender.
Yeah, they really shouldn't have gender.
It really smacks of gender, but I've heard, you know, it's different because there's so many of them, and they go through different generations and time periods within Pern.
I can't believe the woke mob put gender in Dragon Riders of Pern.
Yeah. Can't believe they went back in time to 1970.
The liberal agenda.
Yeah. But I think I want to try them again because the world genuinely is cool. Mm. It's like one of those, there was a time where sci-fi and fantasy were like the same thing. You didn't have two different genres.
Yeah.
Anything that happened in space was also fantasy, and anything that was fantasy was also sci-fi. Like ElfQuest. ElfQuest, the elves literally came from space. And in Dragon Riders of Pern, it was like people from Earth went out to like colonize planets. And then they used their ships for, like, salvage and forgot they came from Earth. And now they live in a medieval society with dragons that are actually just selectively
like
bred creatures.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. Sounds like it would make for good toys. I'm a little surprised that no one ever mined that for a cartoon.
I think it was a little bit too adult. Like, it was an adult series.
Mm, they keep talking about the dragon ovaries or whatever.
They talk a lot about dragon anatomy.
Uh-oh. All right.
Maybe not that far. But
shot
like,
in the dark. I was just trying to guess.
Not that far, but they do like go into the science of it because they were selectively bred to be dragon-like.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
All right. We got the dragon eugenics in there.
Yeah. But that was one I was disappointed by.
No, yeah, I totally get it. When I was here's my last one, and then I think we'll take a break and move on to the second segment. When I was a kid, I had Wizard Magazine, which is about comic books, mm-hmm. but I didn't read a lot of the comic books that were in those magazines because, paradoxically, the way they sell comic books is to not put them where people are and instead only put them at specialty shops that your town or city probably doesn't have. So my dad would go by the, you know, fucking newsstand or grocery store or whatever, and he would see this magazine with Wolverine on the cover and be like, I'll get that for my kid. And he did. And I could literally do multiple entire episodes on what reading these magazines did to me as a child. But I would like to mention one small story of it, which is that there was an ad for an, at the time, very expensive Gunpla model for the Death Scythe Gundam, because Gundam Wing was airing on TV right at that time. It was the specifically the Endless Waltz version of Gundam Death Scythe. And in my head, looking at this robot with dark black bat wings and a cool laser scythe, I started to imagine all the adventures it must appear in and how cool it must be. And eventually,
thinking of Gundam Wing.
I was thinking of Gundam Wing, and wow, was I off base for what happens in Gundam Wing?
That's or really good.
So you got the Gunpla model, and you didn't realize you had to put it together and paint it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, if I had ever received that model as a child, I would have been disappointed because I just wanted a posable action figure. As an adult, I put it together and I'm like, wow, this looked cooler in the picture. But that was just because I got a low quality Death Scythe. But getting that Death Scythe was very much a, like, my childhood has come full circle thing.
You're squaring the circle on that one.
Yeah. And in a way, this episode is too, which I will talk about more
wow.
in the second segment. All right.
Tintin. Blubbering barnacles, or whatever it says.
Blistering barnacles, something like that.
Yeah.
You gherkin.
Be with us again soon when Tintin and his friends sail the seven seas, fight with bloody pirates, and live through breathtaking dangers. Watch for the next series of Hergé's Adventures of Tintin.
You ready to go back in?
Yeah. Let's tin it up.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to Please Don't Listen to This, Your Life Depends on It, the show where we do something different every single week. And this week, I had our panel here read Tintin and the Secret of the Unicorn and Tintin and Red Rackham's Treasure. So those are two of the collected Tintin stories. We read these digitally. You can find them on the computer or hopefully at your local library. Mm-hmm. And
you can download an app or a computer program to read .c whatever
.cbz files.
Yep. Yeah,
they used to be .cbr files, but somehow things got moved around since I was doing this.
They moved the R to the Z.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think they made it so that it works on phones. I think that was the difference.
They got phone. We have the technology.
But these were from the 40s. In between Secret of the Unicorn and Red Rackham's Treasure, World War II starts. So it's,
I didn't have that bit of context. That's good.
There's a funny bit in one of like the post, in one of the oral histories that's like, well, there was a bit of a delay in the production of Red Rackham's Treasure because the war started and he's in Belgium. And it's like, oh, that's how that happens.
Yeah.
It's like that would cause a delay. But in some of these stories were published daily in a daily paper. You get one page at a time.
All right.
Which helps illustrate how these stories are paced out sometimes, mm-hmm. where they've got
weird, have a joke a page.
Weird stops and starts.
It's
weird,
very comic strip style.
Weird gags in certain places. Yeah. Some of it leads to very funny pacing, but when I was a kid, certain Tintin books, particularly Secret of the Unicorn, captured my imagination in a way that not many other stories did. I loved my superhero comics and I loved my regular books, and I had like kind of a ravenous appetite for reading in general. But there was something about these that felt different, which I didn't understand at the time was because they were European and also from 60 years ago. But because they were so different, because it felt like in my mind anything could happen in them, the rules of what you were allowed to show to children were slightly different over there. Some you could have an alcoholic character.
Yeah.
Somebody could die even if it was off screen.
Your main character could shoot a gun at some point.
Yes, yeah. Your main character could shoot a gun.
How old is Tintin supposed to be? Is he like...
I want to say he's supposed to be like 20, but I could be wrong.
Okay, he seems younger, but he also has
like
his own
14,
flat.
He looks like he's 14, but
yeah.
Acts like he's 20.
Yeah. In the first stories, they're calling him Boy Reporter.
Yeah.
But they kind of drop that as time goes on.
No, they just call him Reporter.
And yeah. And, well, and they don't, like, he seems like he has no problem, like, living on his own. Nobody ever asks why he's not in school or anything like that, you know? So I just assume he's, like, young adult.
Yeah.
Like, and of course, you know, this is, things might be a little different in Europe about whether or not they immediately execute kids if they try to cross the street without an adult's help.
Mm-hmm.
But this is – and that may, of course, have been why I found some of this so captivating. But also because of the mystery of it. Secret of the Unicorn doesn't exactly end on a cliffhanger, but it definitely has a big tease for what's coming next.
Tintin turns to camera and says, yeah. Check out the next one.
Check out the Secret of Red Rackham's Treasure. It's like knowing now that he didn't even know like when that shit was coming out,
yeah.
If he was going to be able to publish it.
Gee, I hope this war doesn't start up.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope things are going to be okay with that war. It could be getting pretty dicey. But that was what like captivated my imagination. And when I was going through in kind of chronological order and reading these Tintin books, my initial thought was that I was going to have you guys do Cigars of the Pharaoh and Tintin and the Blue Lotus, which are some of the better Tintin stories. But one, there's too many racist caricatures. And two, there's no Captain Haddock. And we can't do a Tintin story with no Captain Haddock, because he was one of the things that made it exciting for me as a kid to have this like surly drunkard sailor
old, weird
around on
captain.
All these adventures,
yeah.
And he's a good source of comedy.
He's got uncle energy.
And, yeah, he does have uncle energy, yeah. And that's he's one of the guys that you would want to have around for Tintin to bounce off of, to make the dialogue better, to make the action scenes and the comedy scenes flow better. And I was kind of delighted and disappointed in equal measure by my
when was the last time that, the first time you like have you I, revisited
I was,
these since?
No, I have not. Okay. I have not revisited these at all. Like I have a lot of comics and books from when I was a kid. I have sort of done a check to see if I remember them right.
You need to
with
do
Tintin,
the nostalgia check. It's important.
With Tintin, I haven't seen. It's like kind of hard. They're not like out of print or anything, but I just haven't really seen them around. And the digital editions, if you go and try and get them on the Kindle store, they're all fucked up. Like, somebody didn't bother to try and scan them correctly. So
they're
it's
not
like,
as good as these illegal transfers.
Yeah, these illegal transfers are amazing. Like, it's really kind of a shame. And this is why piracy is important to preservation.
It's good. We like it. Please don't listen to this. Your Life Depends on It supports piracy.
Uh-huh. Especially these stories for stories about pirates, like The Secret of the Unicorn.
It's true.
Yeah. But this story
Files are the real treasure.
This story kind of starts with a loose thing that doesn't get connected until later about a pickpocket on the streets. Now, it's unclear where Tintin lives. At the start of Tintin's adventures, it's pretty clear that it's a Belgian comic. He's supposed to be living in Belgium. But as time goes on,
it seems
the way
like
they write
in England.
It. Yeah, the way they write it, he's just like clearly in England. So it's super
I don't know if
strange.
It's a translation thing, because there's other things that
he says blimey.
They talk about him living in... When they do the made-up places, it's like, we're going to go down the road to blank Shire. It's like, oh, you live in England for sure.
But I think it's a translation thing because they changed names from the Belgian to
But in Tintin and the Black Island, they take a boat that's not like a huge boat. They take like a tiny boat to what appears to be like a rocky, like craggy kind of island. You know, they're like, oh, you know... Ireland's just a day away kind of thing. So it makes me think that like he's in that kind
Belgium
of area.
Belgium is not that far from the sea.
Oh,
I guess that's right.
But
like
so in so the Thompson and Thompson.
Yeah.
The two cop characters.
the detectives.
Special investigators.
Yeah.
Love those guys.
In the French, uh-huh. In the Belgian French, they are Dupont and Dupont.
Oh,
so,
that's cute.
Yeah. And then I think Snowy is Mio. So like they definitely changed
it's
names. So it might be a translation
a teen
thing.
Tintin.
We love a Tintin.
But we start with an incredible pickpocket on the street that leads to some really good gags about people having their wallets stolen.
The wallet stuff is really
good. In the movie, that gag is so much better.
What?
God, so you go into the shop and you're like chasing, they're chasing the guy. It was like so much better.
All right, well, look, I'll get around to the movie eventually. I do want to watch it.
Yeah.
But I'm balking at that, not because I think the movie is bad or whatever, but because I love this gag so much in the comic of like the way they constantly illustrate these characters reaching to pay for something because they're like, oh, somebody...
Wallet's gone?
Yeah, well, somebody else doesn't have their wallet. I'll get it for you. Let me pay for it. And it's like, oh, my wallet's gone too.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important because Tintin is buying a tiny replica boat and people keep trying to buy it off of him. And we eventually discover that this ship is a model of the ship, the Unicorn, which Sir Francis Haddock, who is supposed to be like Sir Francis Drake, used to sail on, and he kept all his treasure and he... hit it after it was stolen from Red Rackham, and Tintin meets up with his friend Captain Haddock from the adventure of the Crab with the Golden Claws, and there is a really funny sequence of him describing his ancestry but acting it out the whole time.
He's read his whole diaries and he's acting it out, and it's intercut with like the panels of the actual events,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll keep cutting back to what Haddock is doing in the room, like,
and he's like
stabbing the pillows of his couch.
So then Sir Francis drank all the rum, and Tintin's like, no, he didn't, he was sober. And Haddock's like, right, of course, what am I saying, he was sober. And so he puts the rum down and starts to go do something else.
That was one of my favorite bits. It was very
yeah.
But this leads directly into the main plot of Secret of the Unicorn, which is them trying to decipher these clues to see where what Sir Francis Haddock was trying to point them towards, and like where the treasure from this story could have ended up, and why people are after him for it now. Because people who we've got some ne'er-do-wells who are like seriously trying to kill off Tintin and Haddock. And then of course
kidnapping the murder plots.
Yeah, kidnapping and murder plots. And also Thompson and Thompson keep getting their wallets stolen throughout the story. And that is Secret of the Unicorn. That is the one that I had already read as a child. And then Red Rackham's Treasure is the story of like them actually going to try and find this treasure.
After they have the clue to where it is, they got to try and find it.
And the boat journey, and you meet Professor Calculus and his hard of hearing thing, which I thought I was going to get really annoyed with, but I actually ended up
I started getting
it.
A little bit annoyed with it, but then at the end, Haddock puts him in front of a reporter. And it's really funny because the reporter's trying to interview him about the whole thing, and he just leaves completely confused.
Yeah, it's just like totally useless trying to talk
to him. Calculus is having a completely different conversation.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know what you guys thought of these dusty ass comic books written by, an old Belgian racist. Hergé's Tintin and the Secret of the Unicorn, Red Rackham's Treasure. Seb, what did you think?
I thought these two comics were very charming. Unfortunately, I was the entire time kind of making comparisons to the movie. So. The Secret of the Unicorn is almost one for one, the opening to the Spielberg movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Red Rackham's Treasure, they take some elements of it, but apparently the Golden Crab Claw or the
Crab with the, crab golden, with claws. The golden
Claws, apparently they take from that for the
it's
second
a good one to take from. That's the first one that has Captain Haddock in it.
Yeah.
There's wait, so does that mean they have like opium smuggling in the movie? Because that's like the main thrust of the plot of Crab with the Golden Claws.
All right.
Yeah. They do go to the Middle East.
Is it really opium smuggling? That's great.
I think it was they were presenting the ship, like one of the ships to like a prince or something over there. It's been almost a year since I watched it.
In Cigars of the Pharaoh, there's a huge opium smuggling scheme as well, which is great. Because there's like a lot of like drugs and guns as like things that criminals could be after in early Tintin stories. This one is more tame in that sense, but it's not a trend that would continue. Like, it's just these are two isolated incidents of where Tintin's not getting shot at or people are dealing drugs around him. Because that just stuff that did happen all the time in these stories.
But there's this whole way more of a conspiracy around everything in the movie. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the guys who was trying to buy the ship off of Tintin, Ivan Somethingovich, whatever mm-hmm. that guy was.
The collector.
Yeah, he just happened to be a collector in the comics. In the movie, he's actually a descendant of Red Rackham.
He literally is.
It, like, the movie... like builds up to this confrontation between Haddock and him, and there's this really crazy big fight scene, and it's like really good.
Oh, that sounds good. In the Tintin books, they do often have like a main villain, but the only one that's ever recurring is a guy called Rastapopoulos, who is the first time he is introduced is in The Cigars of the Pharaoh. And he is a movie director, and there's a really funny scene that got me especially hard as a modern reader, where somebody's it affected me especially as a modern reader because
it sounds like it.
They show a white blonde woman getting like kidnapped by someone who appears to be like a rough criminal type, and Tintin rushes in to try and punch the guy, and then it zooms out and Tintin's like fucking up a movie shoot, and
that's good.
And oh no,
he's like the executive paying for the movie, but that's just his cover to be there while he like sells drugs and it does like guns for drugs deals, and it's very, but like he doesn't get like thrown in jail at the end of that. He just doesn't exactly get away with it, but he just gets discredited. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, 20 years later, Hergé decides that he wants to use that guy in a story again. And they do some fun stuff with that.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, the movie is very, very good. But onto the comic. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated the art style in this. The art style is called Ligne Claire.
Yeah.
Clear Line, which is notable for a lot of comics. Like Hergé.
Did you look this up or you knew this? From your schooling?
Well, I knew this. No, I didn't know it from schooling.
Okay.
I knew this was a style. I didn't know exactly what it was called. Ligne Claire. Clear line.
Clear line.
Okay. this was especially popularized by Hergé. And basically, it's characterized by very clear lines, very defined. very, very clear lines without a lot of variation. Flat colors. I feel like it's a very good style for publication in a serialized like magazine or newspaper, just because
I can't imagine getting one page of this at a time.
You'd have
totally
to save
insane.
All your papers yeah, to yeah. read it through like mm-hmm. a real book.
But the paper would come out every day.
Yeah.
It's
like 2 months of serialization of every day
for
that's,
one
that's
story.
Oh no. But yeah, so very good for printing, and it's just also a very elegant, expressive style, and you can find it in a lot of other later comic strips. And then Mobius. Everyone knows Mobius.
Oh, yeah. The Living Vampire?
No. the illustrator Mobius.
No, I actually don't know who that is, so you're going to need to give me
some. I'm going to show you some of his stuff, and you'll probably recognize
it. Yeah, Nick's got this covered. Yeah, I really appreciate the art style, and I like the colors and everything. Though some of the scans seemed like they were color corrected and some didn't, but I think that was just the age of the comic that they had.
No, I don't know who that is.
Stuff like this? It's the inspiration for a lot of sci-fi costuming, including Star Wars, was taken from his illustrations.
No, I've never seen Mr. Mobius.
Okay.
Dr. Michael Morbius.
Anyway, so, I appreciated that, and I also kind of appreciated what we're talking about at the top of the episode, which was the globe-trotting aspect, which they didn't really trot much the globe.
Not in this one.
This is like a pirate story. Yeah. This is definitely like a different genre. Well, not a different genre, but
the Black Island is another one where they don't go very far, but it's another good adventure story.
Yeah, in this one, they just, like, or in Red Rackham, they go out to an island, talk about possible cannibals. Fortunately, there are no cannibals.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I'm like, uh-oh.
Yeah, the only racist things that we actually encountered this time around were the one gag I was talking about. And then the mention of cannibals. But instead they find, I thought this gag was really funny. It was really adorable. Where through successive generations, the parrots on this island have just been repeating things that Captain Haddock's ancestor, Sir Francis, said, which are like the same strings of like, not swears, but just exclamations of words and stuff like that. Ration my rum and stuff like that.
That's a good bit.
It was a really good bit. I thought that was really cute. And then I really liked the submarine looking like a shark. It's adorable.
Yeah,
it's an
that's
adorable
a great
shark.
Design.
It's great.
It's funny how like literally 5 pages are the propeller getting tangled in seaweed. Like, can you imagine a whole week being like, how is Tintin going to get out of this one?
Yeah.
He can't breathe. He's stuck down there.
Yeah. And, you know, they actually get in some pretty... I mean, you know he's going to get out, right? You know it's never going to be
dark.
He's
held at gunpoint.
But he's held at gunpoint. He almost suffocates under the water.
Uh-huh.
Twice.
You know, that kind of stuff. There's other cute gags like Snowy the dog. They've got Professor Calculus has like snuck on board with his submarine.
Uh-huh.
This guy's so persistent. He took
all the whiskey out of the whiskey.
Yeah.
And then he's like just swiping things from around the ship, and they're like, Snowy, what are you doing? Because at first it seems like things that the dog would take. And then they're like, oh, we can't blame him for swiping your rum. And then he comes up and he's drunk. Like the dog is drunk. But it turns out that it's because the rum has been like smashed. And he did not actually steal it. He was just drinking.
The dog did actually take the whole chicken, though.
He did actually take the whole chicken.
I was like, that's good.
And he's eating it. Yeah, Snowy's very cute. I wish he did more than just the one thing he did in the
first. He saves them in the first one.
Yeah, he saves him in the first one.
Kind of.
He goes and like finds him, and he kind of tries to help fend off the criminals that captured Tintin. I don't know, like, I just thought it was a good, fun time. And I would probably read more of these if you can curate for me, Nick. Because I don't want to slog through, like, a bunch of racist shit or a bunch of stuff that's not actually that good.
So there are a bunch of really good ones, but you do kind of have to dodge around them. I mean,
I can get over, like, of the time racist stuff.
Handle that, then I would recommend the first ones that are good are Cigars of the Pharaoh and Tintin and the Blue Lotus. And there's plenty of good stuff in both of those. But I was hesitant to recommend them here for the reasons I said. The racist caricatures and no Captain Haddock.
Yeah.
Those are the two reasons.
I mean, we did get into it on the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen episode for the comic about whether...
That's another one that kind of looks back to the pulp adventure serial story.
Yeah, and whether it's okay to enjoy those things when they have of the time stuff. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was leaning into that stuff when it didn't have to because it was, you know, from the 2000s. I find the globe-trotting stuff pretty enjoyable. As a kid, I had a video game. It was Pitfall: The Lost Expedition.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. Modern Pitfall, Atari Pitfall game?
Yeah, it was actually pretty fun. I appreciate that kind of stuff.
Oh, I just remembered something I wanted to do for an episode.
Do you want to do the Cigars of the Pharaoh video game?
Are we calling it now?
No, I am absolutely not.
Are you going to call your shot?
I'm not calling my shot because this is a lot to ask. So, I mean, it's not necessarily.
Do we have to go around the world in 80 days?
Yeah.
No, talking about these pulp kind of guys and you saying Pitfall reminded me of Spelunky, a game I really love that I would like
to have.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, you've been talking about us doing that for an episode for ages.
And I will do it at some point. It is probably not my next one.
Okay.
My next one will be something else that we'll figure out later.
Yeah. But yeah, I enjoyed this. I don't think there's like a ton of deep analysis or anything.
No, it's mostly just it's mostly just like, were you able to like get that wonder and enjoy it? And did you laugh when Thompson and Thompson were milling the oats? Like,
like all the little gags that you don't get gags like that anymore. Like little slapstick things or just like character humor.
It's like Looney Tunes ass, Three Stooges ass shit.
Yeah,
it's
don't get one bit characters anymore, which isn't bad, but also I kind of wish we had some simple stuff like that.
I think it's thinking it is bad.
No. I think part of what we're missing here is like the universality of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you write a joke, usually a lot of it is dependent on language.
right? And it's dependent on your audience also. Right. Like, you write the joke for your audience, but this kind of stuff could be for any audience. Anybody would laugh at, the parrots are saying the same thing after like 200 years.
Joke about TikTok? Yeah. Oh, man.
Listeners, I apologize for the jokes I made about TikTok. No, like when Thompson and Thompson are like fucking pumping the air, and they talk about how sick they are pumping the air, and then they're like, we're going into the country where we're going to be doing no mechanical pumping, and the first thing they do when they get there is grind the barley for the fucking goats.
Yeah, and it's like the same mechanism.
It's the exact same machine. Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's a good
bit. There's that. There's the parrots. There's the drunk dog. It, like, everybody has had a dog who's gotten into shit you shouldn't get into, or cat, like me, which is...
Friend of the show, Josh, had a story. He had a tiny corgi named Dexter.
Yep.
And one time they had ordered multiple pizzas for a party, and one of them went missing.
Entire pizza?
Yes, an entire pizza that he dragged off somewhere, and they couldn't find it. And later he was, like, you know, groaning on the ground because he's like, it's like you tried to eat that entire damn thing. Pizza that is bigger than this dog.
And he probably had the worst shits for like a week. Yeah.
I don't remember that part of the story, but I'm sure that he did.
Definitely.
My cat Biff, growing up, he was so food aggressive. Mm-hmm. He would steal an entire flank of ham off of the table. Wow. Like he had done that once. He was a fucking menace.
What's a cat gonna do with that much ham?
Eat it.
Wow.
He would. Biff absolutely would have eaten that entire piece of ham.
Well, I'm happy that you got to go through it. And
this is like good stuff.
Alex, what did you think of Secret of the Unicorn and Red Rackham's Treasure?
I enjoyed both of these. I touched on this stuff a little bit, but Haddock is very Popeye to me. I couldn't really get that connection out of my head. This feels of the era. I don't really know how they compare as far as when they were published or like.
I think Popeye's a bit earlier.
Popeye is like 15 years earlier. Popeye's a 30s character. Well, actually, now that I think about it, when did The Crab with the Golden Claws came out? I'm pretty sure that was at least 1940.
Yeah.
So Popeye had been around for a while.
He definitely has a little bit of a different like vibe as a character, but I saw like. A combination of Popeye and Mr. Krabs in Captain Haddock.
Well, both those characters and Captain Haddock all come from the same idea of a stereotypical sailor that does not exist anymore because of what, you know, because of the way we have travel now. but a kind of sailor who was a fast-talking alcoholic who had a lot of colorful language that didn't always quite make sense to somebody who was on
rambling about sea stories. Uh-huh.
They first appeared the same year.
Really?
Well, not Haddock, but Tintin was first published in 1929, and so was Popeye.
How about that? That's interesting. I wonder if they were getting American cartoons over there in Belgium. That's a decent question.
But
I mean, E.C. Cigar did his Popeye comics back in the 20s, so
I definitely had Popeye in the brain when I was reading this, but I think it's mostly because it was my only real touch point for a comic this old.
Oh, yeah.
But it's interesting. Like, those are like a little bit different in premise. The adventure structure is good. We touched on that a little bit. I like that this is a two-parter. I don't know. Did they do that many of those?
They did a couple of them. It wasn't an every time thing, but
I like that this story had two whole issues or whatever to breathe.
Cigars of the Pharaoh and the Blue Lotus is another one. The one where Tintin goes to the moon is a two-part story.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, at least one more. But not all of them were. Some of them are more self-contained. But this is like this works really well like as a two-part story where the first one is not really going anywhere.
Yeah, the setup for the adventure and then the adventure is good. Because I think putting both halves of that story in 60 pages would have felt a little too fast, maybe.
Overstuffed, yeah.
But I enjoyed this. I think I like the second part a little bit more when they're on the ship. I think the jokes are a little bit better.
Yeah.
Probably one of my favorite jokes was when they reach the island, Haddock has a shotgun and he leaves it behind by a tree and the monkeys pick it up. And then the fucking two guys,
Thompson and Thompson,
they like mimic like they're shooting with their cane, and then the monkeys learn how to shoot the gun. They're like, oh, we'll scare him like this. Yeah.
It's like how the monkey doesn't know how to shoot it now, but you're teaching him how to do it.
It was so fucking fun. And they shoot through Haddock's hat. Like, they almost kill him.
They do some good stuff with animals in this that they don't normally necessarily get to in these Tintin stories, although there is a really funny one in, I want to say it's in Cigars of the Pharaoh, where Tintin, like, gives an elephant some medicine, and then the elephant carries him back to civilization. It's a funny bit. But,
yeah,
the kind of nice little slapstick or gags. Yeah, like,
I was big into all the gags. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the overarching story as it got going, but I was like super down for the Thompson brothers like falling down the stairs every other page.
Yeah, getting their hats stuck on their faces. Yeah. Their heads.
The bit with the elastic wallet I thought was so funny.
The elastic wallet's incredibly funny. The chain on the wallet is good. Uh-huh. And then the payoff for all the wallet stuff was incredibly funny. That he's got it on like a shelf. Everyone's wallet that he stole. And then it's like, and Tintin is like, tells the Thompson guys, he's like, you guys ought to check under T here.
Yeah,
and
he's like, all right, T.
Thompson, just all the wallets he's had stolen through the course of the story.
It was like a pile of 15 wallets. I think that was my favorite gag. I really, really got a kick out of that. I mentioned earlier, I like when Haddock is recounting the story that he read and they intercut it with what he's like, how he's acting it out and how
he's like jumping on a table, waving around a sword.
The movie does a really good thing with that where it's playing, you know, the narrative, like it's in a flashback. And then every time he's like, yeah, and then Francis Haddock, he like got some rum and drank some rum, and then it'll do it in the flashback, and then Tintin's like, no, he didn't, and then it'll like replay it.
And they go back.
Yeah,
that's funny. Yeah, the mystery is interesting. Like the boat stuff was
the eagle crossed. Like where do we go from here? And then it's like, oh, actually, we could have taken the whole day off. Like,
yeah,
it's, oh, it was
the resolution of that is.
But like,
is
how long were they out at sea? There, it was
like
over
like
a month,
2 weeks, or a month, or
no,
something.
No, because at one point it's like a fortnight later. Like, and that's in the middle of it.
I don't know.
But that's 2 weeks.
Yeah,
isn't it? So
now it's just a game you play on your phone.
Yeah.
What? But anyway, I enjoyed this. I think this got at what you were trying to get at. This definitely was, even though I never read these, definitely was a good nostalgia hit. It was definitely a thing that felt classic and easy and
effortless.
Wanted
something that was a little light because we had just done the gigantic movie episode. But I also had been thinking a lot about this because I've been reading through a bunch of stuff I couldn't get my hands on in a normal way. And these stood out to me because they're kind of, for some reason, hard to get, even though they've been in print and they're still in print now in English and in all kinds of other languages. And this was kind of a mixed experience of like the total anticlimax in Red Rackham's Treasure. Like, there's no final action set piece in that.
Yeah,
but
they're like, oh,
we still
found the treasure.
It is a satisfying ending, but not an exciting one.
I feel like the
first book has the more straightforward climax.
Yeah.
Yes, it does, in a way that I actually do like. The climax with the thief and with Tintin getting kidnapped. Mm-hmm.
And that is like the slapstick order of events that gets him out of there is fascinating.
Yes, really,
too.
Really good.
I mean,
stuff.
Jerry rigs a big pendulum. That was like, holy shit, this guy can do this.
Yeah, he's like just going to like fucking battering ram his way out of a stone cellar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
Super good.
The comedy of errors of like knocking the suit of armor over and then like dropping a thing and it hitting a drum and like all that.
Sticking a broom out through the banister on the stairs. So
he
all the
trips
guys
those guys like rule of three, like at least three times.
Mm, that's how you defeat the boss.
It's so funny.
I did like the end of Red Rackham being, Captain Haddock has his family home back. Like he's, you know, got it all now. And he's actually doing something for everybody. He's like, oh, come see this stuff. Like,
yeah, he does like an installation, like a museum, which I think it's very warm and satisfying, you know?
Yeah, and he's actually sort of getting along with Professor Calculus, where Calculus keeps repeating the same thing, but instead of being like, about it, he's kind of like, no, I said this.
Yes.
No.
But, like, I still ended up really enjoying my experience with this. I was wondering going into this, and I'm like, am I going to find out that this is stupid shit for babies as I'm reading this? And like, you know, of course, it definitely is. Like, through the eyes of a child, I instilled a lot more wonder into some of these stories than is there. But I also found that I was really enjoying myself, being able to appreciate it without like having this like weird mystery. Like, how come, like, what am I supposed to know about these two guys? Or like, You know, I don't know about Captain Haddock or where's Tintin 1. Like, it's like, actually just enjoy what you have, and you can appreciate like a self-contained adventure like this. It's a light read. There's not like a ton of text like there are in some of the other fucking comic books I've had you guys read.
Yeah, it's no Watchmen.
Yeah, it's no Watchmen or fucking From Hell any of the other stuff that I've busted out.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you were like, where's number one? Because in picking this up, like the first part I'm like able to get on board pretty quick because it's the first part of the adventure. But I was thinking, like, if you pick up book two, it would maybe make no sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, if you read it unrelated, like, you hadn't read book one. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was just the way I was thinking of as a kid. I'm like, well, I enjoy this, so I would obviously want to start at the beginning.
Yeah.
But as I found out now, you don't want to do that. You can skip the first three, and you'll be fine. But thank you so much for doing this. I'm happy this was something nice and light.
Yeah, this was a good one.
I'm sure the tone will be completely the same as we move on to next week's topic. Seb, what is that? I heard we're shooting Pikachu with a gun.
Yeah, next week we're playing Pal World, the hit sensation that Nick doesn't... Or
the
one-month-old
hit sensation. Yeah. It's not relevant anymore.
It's okay, I'm on Game Pass, so I can just...
He's only playing real Pokemon and using his freaking computer programs and still trying to get shinies, and I don't even know what you're doing with this anymore.
No, you've got it.
So, yeah, we're playing Pal World. I got sucked into it a little bit by a friend of the show, Bink, and a friend of ours, Clara. We've been playing on a server together. I would recommend play with other people.
Wow.
And we can all get together and
play. Is there crossplay on this damn thing? Probably not, right? That means we're going to
all
going to
play it on the damn computer, though, right?
Yeah, but I have Game Pass and I know it's on there. So I was thinking like, oh, if I get it on Game Pass, I don't have to pay for it.
I don't know. I'll look into that.
I will pay for it if I have to.
It's only $30.
Yeah. That's fine. I can do that.
Oofa.
Yeah. But yeah, we'll that's what we're doing.
All right. We are going to be a little late to the flavor of the month next week on
Flavor of 2 months ago.
Your light depends on it. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye.
Blistering barnacles.
Tintin.
Ration my rum.